This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It is not good, obviously, that this is happening within what should be a trusted circle of likely military intelligence. But it also indicates that there may be a broader problem.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. There has been a lot of news about Russia and the war in Ukraine in the last few weeks, from the recent revelation that intelligence documents have been leaked to the Wall Street Journal reporter who's being wrongfully detained in Russia. So with everything that's going on, we're going to talk to my good friend Molly McHugh about these developments and how they can shape the war. Molly is a writer and researcher, as most of you know, of Russian influence and information warfare. Her articles have appeared in Politico, Wired, The Washington Post, Lawfare, and other publications. And she's the lead author of a newsletter called GreatPower.us. She's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and one of the only people I've ever been to a war zone with. Hi, Woo! Molly.
Well, hello.
Welcome back. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah?
I guess.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Okay, so we recorded this conversation last week before we knew the identity of the leaker. So after that news broke, we decided to sit down again and discuss what we know now. Last Thursday, FBI agents arrested Jack Teixeira, an Air Force National Guard airman who has been charged with leaking the documents. Teixeira had access to the documents as part of his job in cyber defense operations with the Air National Guard. And the New York Times is reporting that based on charging documents, Teixeira isn't being accused of acting as a foreign agent, which would mean stealing documents to aid a foreign government or enemies of the United States, or as a whistleblower, which would be sharing secret information with news media to educate the public about some sort of at least perceived corruption. According to the reporting from the New York Times and the Washington Post, his goal was to share the documents with a small circle of online friends in a Discord chat where they discussed games, guns, and shared memes, including racist and anti-Semitic slurs. We're still not entirely sure if or how the racism or anti-Semitism impacted the motive here, although the group did use the title Bear versus Pigs in their discussion about the war in Ukraine. The Times is reporting that Teixeira shared top secret documents and risked spending 15 years in prison to impress some people online. Molly, how does the motive here shape how you see and understand this leak and the broader impact it can have on national security concerns?
I mean, it does fit with what we were seeing, just knowing from the documents that the stuff had been online for a long time. It seemed to be specific to this one group, which then eventually was sort of set free into the wilderness of online things. So it does fit in that sense of, like, it didn't seem like a person who was doing this specifically for the purpose of whistleblowing, of transmitting it to a foreign power, of XYZ things. But it seemed to be, and what we can now say with a fair degree of certainty, and there may be secondary motives we don't understand, that he stole the stuff beginning at around the time of the beginning of the new phase of the war in Ukraine, and has been sharing it with his little online bro group since, in order to inflate his status in the group. And I think he's probably not the only one in the group who was lying about who he was. He was portraying himself as, like, this super secret operator, type dude. He's a guy who's never been to war. And I'm not, kudos to everyone in non-kinetic jobs in the U.S. military and National Guard. But this 21-year-old was trying to portray himself as something he wasn't to inflate his status within the group. I think others in the group were lying about who they were in terms of foreign identities and other things. So who the hell knows who was actually looking at any of this stuff? But the fact that this kid comes from this universe of thinking and stuff where your access to secret U.S. classified documents is how you're going to build your profile online, because that's the reality you care about more, is a little bit mind-boggling and terrifying, but not actually that unusual a thing in this day and age. Not excusing any of it. What he was charged with, was essentially retention and transmission of secret classified national defense information, which does seem to indicate, at least thus far, that he did have access to this stuff. He wasn't stealing it. He was just taking it off base, keeping it for his own purposes, sending it to others. I think this was probably the earliest charge on the charging document. It listed one date of this having happened, which is probably like the closest security cam footage they could find of him shoving paper into his pocket and walking out of the base with it. I'm sure there's going to be additional charges. What those are, though, we don't know. But this is, I hope, I think that in general, there has been a lot of recommendation from people who work vaguely in my community of information-y things to the Pentagon, to the military, to different branches of the military, to educate our guys better about this stuff, like how they are exposed online with what they post, how they are approached online, and how they are targeted for sort of recruitment, collection of information, other things. Some of that is happening. There have been sort of one-page briefers produced, especially on, be aware when you're on Discord, the servers where this stuff was happening, not to do these kinds of things. If you're on this app, like if you're using Tinder abroad, be careful about what you're posting about yourself, things like that. So there has been some education about this, but I think we need to do a better job with our servicemen and women of providing this kind of education, making it clear what the consequences are for transmitting information, whether it be actual documents or just the information itself to others. And I think particularly in this younger group, if the vast majority of the U.S. military is under the age of 30, which it is, which is how any military works, right? You depend on young soldiers who then go on and do other things. We're recruiting now heavily from things like Discord, from esports competitions, places where we can acquire young people who are motivated with the skills that we need in a modern army, which includes, people who can pilot drones, people who do cyber things, people who do information things. We need all of these skill sets. The military has been recruiting from these venues. But then what you are getting is teenagers who have been indoctrinated with this edgelord culture of anti-gay, anti-Semitic, anti-whatever, anti-everything mindset, where militia cool is now like kind of a thing, and we need to be aware of how we track that we take it seriously as a potential internal threat, and that we're doing a better job with how we secure information in our own environment. But I have a real concern about the mindset that this kid represents, and even though he is a grown-up, I'm going to call him a kid because he made stupid kid decisions.
How old
is
he?
21. He started stealing this stuff when he was 19, 20, like...
Yeah, because this was, as we talk about later in the episode, this stuff had been out there for a while. We didn't catch it immediately, right? And that in itself is a separate concern.
So he started posting it in February 2022, so before around the time of the new invasion in Ukraine, and was posting it consistently throughout the year. At some point, got tired of retyping the documents, started posting the specific pictures of documents themselves. Which is, in fact, a much worse thing. But sometime in that timeline, someone in the group started posting that to another server for the same purpose, as far as we know, which was inflating his own, online profile as an edgelord in that group, which was a much bigger group. And the name of that underage, I believe, teenager has been posted somewhere in the various reporting. Seems to be just some kid in California. But somewhere from those groups, others then started, because this was no longer a controlled environment, there was less trust in terms of this, you know, that Jack had been saying, don't post this stuff, it's so secret, mm-hmm. you know. From there, it got to another group, and somewhere in the process of this stuff starting to disseminate, a well-established group of Westerners pretending to be Russians, who were a pro-Russian information channel, this woman who identified herself as part of a collective that calls itself Donbass Devushka, that was pretending to be Russian Jew descended somethings, who have been posting about Russia and the war in Ukraine since 2013, 2014, raising money off of this idea. They run a podcast. That's all this pro-Russian stuff, claiming to be a Russian-descended blah, blah from Lugansk. In fact, she was a now retired, I hope, or forcibly retired, unclear, naval officer who was in Washington State. Who US was doing
naval
this stuff.
Officer.
U.S. naval officer who was in Washington State. The guy, some of the NAFO guys online who have been consistently going through and documenting who a lot of these Russian propagandists are, had done a post detailing some of what this individual slash group has done, identifying her by name. And that was picked up in the Wall Street Journal reporting this weekend, that was actually the thing that kind of grabbed this thing from a group and moved it over to the Russian Telegram channels, which makes sense.
Yeah.
And which is what can happen when you take stuff and put it online. But I think this is a really good example of things that we've seen happening since the like release the memo thing blew up way back in the day, which is other groups. I don't even remember which memo it was at this point, but this was this campaign right after Trump got elected, when all these right-wing congressmen started posting these campaigns about releasing some supposedly secret memo about something. But Russian bots sort of found it and put it online and exploded it. And, you know, was it something they made up? No, but they understand the opportunity in information, right? And I think it's this whole cycle of things, understanding disinformation. The online universe is not just a one-way street. The Russians use it for collection, identification. They're very good about watching our discussions and narratives to look for opportunities in what they do. And in this case, this kid gave them like a big giant pile of things, which is a fucking disaster. So
there's one other thing we also learned between then and now, which is that there are just under 100 special forces military members from NATO countries on the ground in Ukraine.
Still not sure that's verified. NATO has denied it.
White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the 14 U.S. troops were on the ground to monitor military aid. And he said the troops are, quote, not fighting on the battlefield. So this to me seems like an important detail, even if it shouldn't be an important detail. It is new information that U.S. troops are actually on the ground in Ukraine when that has been the refrain that we're denying any U.S. troops directly on the ground in Ukraine, even if they're part of a NATO deployment. What does this mean for the war? Is it significant that this is now revealed?
I mean, is it significant? Sure. What are they probably doing? Our guys are probably back by Lviv, where our training base has been, which is, you know, 20 kilometers from the Polish border. So, is it important that we're there? Yes, we should have been there much, much earlier.
Agreed.
All of this makes it much easier. There are other, I think other NATO forces have been doing other things in different ways. I do think that this line of we are not combatants is maintained. So I don't think any of that is different. And no one is talking about sending NATO forces to fight the war. They are there in the capacity of support, which basically they've been doing on FaceTime this whole time, mm-hmm. right? So like, mm-hmm. you know, is it better that they're there directly and less stuff is getting transmitted over electrons? Absolutely. And I do think it's an important symbol and signal about where we are in the fighting. and the kinds of support that we're giving to Ukraine. But this is important. I mean, we have comm systems, we have other things that it just is easier if we are there as a transmission point, if nothing else. So I think it's good. I'm sure other people will go nuts about it. But just to say, the Russians have been saying we've been there all along. So it doesn't change the, like, is it a provocation factor? Because they've been claiming we've been doing this the whole time anyway.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's get back into the episode. Thanks, Molly. Let's get into it. A couple of weeks ago, we'll talk about the docs first. The New York Times reported that U.S. intelligence documents, including some that are marked top secret, were circulating on social media. And officials are saying that most of the documents are real, but that some have been altered. These are photos of printed briefing documents that have been posted on platforms like Twitter and 4chan and Telegram, but they've been on Discord, the messaging platform, since early March. Let's start with the basics. What's in these documents?
It's a variety of stuff that, as you mentioned, is printed out documents from sort of the daily brief that is like accumulated intelligence stuff that goes to a bunch of people, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
By the daily brief, you mean the president's daily brief or PDB?
It's not for the, as far as I know, this is not the presidential daily brief. It's the one that goes it's on the Pentagon side. So the one that goes to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Okay.
So it comes from all the different agencies. There's statistics and other things. But, you know, it's, as noted, you know, sort of top secret, non-foreign, meaning not for foreign eyes, which is not a particularly highly classified thing. This is a widely read brief. It goes to a huge number of people, department heads and, you know, people who are keeping track of Europe, people who are keeping track of other things. So it's not a document that reveals incredibly sensitive, generally speaking, is not a document that reveals incredibly sensitive information about collection methods or sources, things like that. It's just sort of the digest of stuff that you need to see every day to keep on top of the crap you're doing, right? So I think in that respect, it's not the worst thing that could have happened. I just think in some aspects, I think it's the extremely low-tech nature of this that's wigging everyone out, because some person like printed these things out and folded them up, because you can see the folds, like folded it in quarters and shoved it in their pocket and walked out the door of whatever agency they're working in with them, and then sat in their car, because you can see it in some of the photos, like taking pictures of the photo of these documents like on the seat of the car, right? And then posting them to whatever fucking horseshit, and you're just like, what? Like, what are you doing? And so it's that weirdness of like, shit, someone inside the system. And granted, this is, again, a wide range of people. Did this. I think the other thing about this that is raising hackles and made the Pentagon go ballistic when they were notified of this from not within our system, from an ally, is that it was online for more than a month somewhere before somebody else saw it and was like, yo, bro, you think there's these things that are yours? Like, have you seen them? And it wasn't until they crossed over to, I think, on Twitter, like there were a few posts on Twitter that somebody else saw them and was like, have you guys seen this? And in all aspects of that, it's like a giant fail. I think the biggest piece is there's been a lot of debate about this, especially in the context of the most recent phase of the Ukraine war, but also other things, like how well are intelligence agencies understanding and using open source intelligence information? And do we have enough of our own resources pointing in those directions, like looking at everything every day? In the now very dispersed different channels in which information is propagating, so it's not just Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you know, it's all of these new social media things, it's these gamer things, Discord and whatnot. There's a lot of different channels in which stuff is being spread. And the fact that nobody saw it is sort of a big giant fail in many respects. So it's not the end of the world in terms of what it was and what was out there. But it's sort of, it's still like, for me, is like a big, you know, question mark flashing over the head of like, do we really still not have a room full of 20-year-old captains whose job it is to like just search the make internet. Sure that, like look at things and be like, hey, that says top secret on it. Maybe it shouldn't be online. Like, apparently we don't. And that's surprising because we've gotten better about a lot of this stuff than we used to be. But it, part of it is still an authorities issue. Like, are we allowed to do XYZ things or only to do, you know, these other channels? But I think for me, that's still a big question. Yeah.
Okay. So the information that everyone is, very concerned about, what does it actually contain? And what is the, I guess we should go over what the documents actually contain that is serious, that is quite sensitive. And then what has been the impact or what's the potential impact of this information now being known? What's happening?
Yeah, I think the, I think we know what the goal of this leak is, right? And like you, whoever it is that, I mean, and again, we don't know. The Pentagon has said or notioned toward they believe this is either a Russia-linked or Russian-friendly thing that has posted these things. That can mean a lot of things. It could mean like an individual person who has inclinations on the same page as. It could mean a recruited asset of. It could mean a lot of different things. So I think we still don't really know. And there's a lot of questions about the, you know, the chain that this happened. They should be able to figure it all out because anybody who accessed that document, there will be a record of like what it was. This should be a simple, straightforward investigation. But so I think it's sort of this. We know what the goals are, assuming it is a Russia aligned thing. It's to create division in the alliance the same way that the Snowden stuff did, where it was revelations that we spy on our allies as well as our adversaries, which is not a revelation because everybody does it. Like absolutely everybody wants additional information other than from official channels on everybody else. But it's clearly meant to be divisive. It is meant to create problems. It is meant to create hesitance, caution, stall, re-questioning as we go into the spring and toward the summer about how we are supporting Ukraine and the direction in which the fighting there is moving. That, I think, is the biggest potential challenge.
Because Ukraine was preparing for a major counteroffensive, and these documents...
There's absolutely nothing important exposed in these documents. And I would just point out again... This is for me, this is there's nothing important exposed. I think the thing to remember is this is stuff from our stuff. Like the documents that were posted are from our analytics of things.
Okay.
This is not Ukrainian war plans. This is our understanding of what may happen. As noted consistently in the press and from officials making statements constantly, the Ukrainians don't share stuff with us because they don't want it to get leaked and put online or in the New York Times or whatever.
Yeah, because of stuff like this happening.
Basically, every time they give us something, the next day someone hands it to a reporter and it ends up in the interweb. And they're very cautious about that. And even within Ukraine, obviously, there's extremely tight lines of control about who actually knows what the plan is, what the potential plans are. Not because there's not trust, but in a very resistant cell operational concept, you know, you want to have as few people as possible knowing the whole thing, because then it's much less likely that pieces of it could be exposed if people are captured, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's important to note that this is our information, not Ukrainian information that has been exposed. There are a few instances in what has been analyzed and published in various reporting so far of sort of, you know, sort not salacious, but sort of like juicy tidbits from allies, like the thing about the Korean munitions, which we all sort of knew it anyway. South Korea has been supportive of what's happening in Ukraine. And has sold and has become a major weapons supplier in many respects for Europe, because they're quite obviously sophisticated at how they make electronics and other things. The Poles have and a few other countries in Europe have been purchasing South Korean armored vehicles and now munitions. And there was quite a large munitions purchase by the Poles from South Korea. And it was very clear that this was South Korea does not want to pass munitions directly to Ukraine, but is happy to sell them to Poland, knowing that they're
Knowing where they're going.
It's going to be a very brief detour, you know, into Ukraine. There was a lot of internal debate for South Korea. You know, everybody has to make decisions about these things, knowing what the potential costs could be with China, with Russia, with other stuff. Many of our Asian allies, our Asian Pacific region allies, have been really good about supporting Ukraine, Australia, the South Koreans, the Japanese in their own ways. So there was things like that where it's like, kind of knowing that detail that like the South Koreans really agonized about this and figured out a way to do it where they felt legally good, but not directly exposed. Like, does it matter? Sure, it matters. And I'm sure they're pissed about it. But everybody kind of knew this anyway, because it was already reported in public.
Okay.
So I don't really see in what we've seen so far. And again, there could be, you know,
one could be forgiven.
Things we haven't seen yet, but
by reading the headlines, one could be forgiven this was a nuclear bomb of a leak.
This is my problem with the reporting. And, you know, God bless all the reporters who have to cover all these things and who have done a consistently pretty good job in the context of this new phase of fighting in Ukraine of really showing some of the important issues, places where allies have been critical, places where Ukraine has done amazing things. It's hard to report on this stuff, and you want this to be this big salacious story because it's a better story.
But this is not Snowden.
And I just think, like, again, there could be stuff we don't know about. Maybe this person was a secret mastermind downloading buckets of things. Maybe they did exfiltrate tons of data on a hard drive and are now printing things and trying to make it look low tech.
So there could be more. We don't know.
But, I mean, the thing about Snowden that was devastating was one, the amount, but two, the fact that he didn't just take information, he took tools. And he exposed the tool, like the listening tools that the NSA had and how they worked and, you know, how they collected. And that was the thing that was crushing and is still an issue in many, like we're still dealing with the consequences of this within the alliance and the way that these were put out into the world. So this is not Snowden. And I think I'll read one little quote from also friend of Politicology, obviously, John Cipher, former CIA agent. But what he posted about this, I think either today or yesterday, was, you know, the sky is not falling. Our most sensitive collection doesn't make it into documents like this. It's also hard for Russia to make changes. We are still dealing with damage from the from Snowden a decade on. Just give Ukraine what it's asking for. And I think that's the best summary of what I've seen in this so far. It's not Snowden. It's not great. Like, it's obviously not great that someone with access to this stuff is being a dick about it, but and thinks that this is a good way to try to influence U.S. decision-making on Ukraine in general, that they are obviously not ideologically aligned with where we are as a nation, but with probably the other side, or at least in an isolationist bent. That's unnerving and very disconcerting, but it is not so far like the breaking open of our intelligence.
The substance of it has not been.
And the substance isn't that important. Right. And it's not, you know, Ukrainian troop movements. Again, the stuff is already 6 weeks old for the most part. You know, is it a little bit more detail on casualties? The biggest discussion has been this thing about various munition stockpiles and what Ukraine has, what they rely on, the fact that they're going to run out of things if people don't supply them with more. But again, this is not
revelatory breaking news.
Maybe specific numbers of, you know, this particular rocket and the, whatever. But from the beginning, this has been the thing that we know there's a very limited pipeline of stuff to shoot. Ukraine is shooting a lot. It's a third as much as Russia in most cases. But they're shooting a lot more than we expected anyone would have to shoot. And we need more things. Yeah. And we've been, we, the West, we, the alliance supporting Ukraine writ large, have been extremely slow in deciding to do something about this problem we've known about since October 2021. And that's not great. So that's, I think this is the biggest thing that's, the noise is being made about this, but it's not new. It's just, if you actually look at it, it's like, oh yeah, it's actually real. And we still haven't done anything about it. Yeah.
Was any of it news to Russia?
I would assume no. they'll play it up in a lot of different ways. But I don't think any of it is revelatory. The reason that they're sitting there lobbing surface-to-air missiles at Ukrainian apartment buildings, which is obviously not how you shoot those, the reason they're using what they have, basically in, like, trebuchet fashion, it's like, we'll just lob this shit into Ukraine, and it'll blow things up, and entire landscapes will be devastated, just and terrorize. Who cares? Like, maybe eventually they'll stop. Is this idea that if they keep grinding, we will stop supporting Ukraine faster than they run out of things. And that calculation has not changed. And I think, as Cipher noted, Russia does not have vast capacity to make operational adjustments quickly. So anything they've seen in this is not really changing the strategy of just grinding. They don't really have a different approach to bring to this.
But playing up the fact that there was a leak in the first place obviously suits their purposes because it demoralizes American support.
It's honestly, it reminds me so much of the Podesta email leak, right? Where like, okay, I also found it fun to read salacious internal emails between the Podesta brothers about their mom's risotto recipe or whatever, you know, like, sure, it was super fun. But was there anything in there that was like, actually, no, it's just that you could say, oh, there were 33,000 leaked emails or whatever. And everybody assumed that there was stuff in there that was bad. And like, you know, it's just, and it's the same with these documents for now, is like the fact of the leak. And again, I think the low techiness of it feels very Cold War.
It does.
Like, it's in my pocket. I snuck it out, you know, and I had a little camera in my pen and I took pictures. It feels not good. And it is not good, obviously, that this is happening from within what should be a trusted circle of likely military intelligence. But and the Russians will play that up, absolutely. But it also indicates that there may be a broader problem of people who have access to these things who are passing on information. But we don't know that. Like, we just don't know.
Can I go down a brief detour for a second? At the risk of you taking me out back and
never
because you brought up Snowden and I just got to know.
Don't do it, Ron. Don't do the Snowden as a hero thing, or I will absolutely throw you out now.
Okay, but maybe not a hero, but
Snowden is a traitor. Period. End of story.
Spying on Americans is also not great. And like, no, I.
The twisting of motivation is the problem, where like maybe you in fact believe spying on Americans isn't great. And he'll,
not
of course,
consent.
And he'll, I'm not arguing that spying on Americans is great. It is not. But maybe you, as the guy who is aware of these things as a very low level contractor or whatever, is unnerved by this fact of the thing, but being duped into exporting all of the other things and then weakening your own nation by exposing all of these things and the tools in terms of dividing the alliance, and then going and enabling an adversary in all of these respects and continuing to be a propaganda tool for them, like, sorry, fail. Like, total fail. So if you actually believe in what you're saying, expose the thing and go to jail for the 5 years and come out as a hero. Okay. And he didn't do that, right?
I'm with you on that.
Don't end up in Russia because you're a dummy.
Yeah, I agree on that point. And everything that happened afterward, I am not a fan of his conduct. However, the revelation of the fact that we were spying on Americans, still are.
Everybody spies on everybody.
Seems worthy of a really robust debate.
Elon Musk is also spying on Americans.
Sure, but he's not the government.
Nobody seems to be
unnerved
about
that.
Sure, right. Sure. Like, you know, is it worthy of robust debate? Yes. Are we already, like, despite having absolutely no data privacy of any kind in this country, are we already in a slightly better position than many of our European peers? Yeah. Like, if you watch any British cop show, it's all they have to do is be like, we think this person was standing in the same room as this person. We're going to access all of their financial records and every phone call they've ever made in history and where their car has gone and where it's like they're just totally allowed to do all that because it's just the laws are different. So do I think that we should have full surveillance powers on our citizens with a low threshold? No, I do not, obviously. But I think that the fact that Snowden was, it seems certainly, recruited for this purpose as a vulnerable target and duped into doing all of these other things that have had extreme cost.
Okay, I can see the nuance. I can see the nuance.
It was a project. Like, it wasn't like,
yeah,
you know, this wasn't in a very Chelsea Manning like situation. It was a vulnerable person
who
was
different situation. I think that was worse, actually.
It's way worse and way more coercive. Yeah. But these people are targeted, and this is why it's like they learn about how these things happen, and there are proper channels through which to go to communicate these things. And
those proper channels would never have.
And you could go to the Hill, because there's plenty of allies on the Hill who agree with you that surveillance on Americans is bad. Like, there's just so many ways to do this within the system that don't involve Glenn Greenwald and the Russians. And when you fail to try to do those things before running to an adversary, I'm just not going to be on your side. Even when your initial point may have been vaguely correct. Yeah. Like, it's just not.
Do you think that sorry, I know this is a complete detour from Ukraine, but I'm just curious. Do you think that the manner in which he went about this and then his conduct since has actually stepped on the possibility of a real robust conversation about spying on Americans? And
probably
he's got to get around it differently, because we haven't had any, there have been zero real repercussions from that revelation.
Internally, there have been. And I do think there have been improvements. Again, not knowing as obviously a person not inside the listening mechanism. I do think there have been improvements in approvals, how these things are done, the kinds of information that are needed or that you're allowed to listen to. But like, it's again, this challenge, and I'm not making excuses for things that are obvious violations, but it's this challenging environment now of the line between domestic and foreign, American and non-American.
Yes.
Is so freaking blurry and hazy.
Barely exists.
That it is a really challenging basket of things. And we need to be competitive in how we are in that space of collection and analysis. Yeah. But obviously, especially given some of the challenges we've had with people who have been elected and how they have sought to abuse these tools.
Yeah.
We need to be always mindful of the internal watchdog aspect of how we go about this and, and analyze ourselves. Absolutely.
I want to bookmark this because
I
think
we should come back to
I think there's
people who know more about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Than me.
I think a round table about this specific topic. I mean, I'm very interested in it. Okay. Back to Ukraine and the documents. Okay, so beyond Ukraine, the fact that the leak happened, how could this, is this, will this change the way allies share information with the U.S.? Like, outside of the, has there been a lot of increased sensitivity as a result of this leak? Not necessarily information in it, but the fact that it happened. And
the main change that we have visibility on so far is that less people have access to the daily brief than used to, right? Like, less people can click on it in the thingy, the server thingies, and actually see it. These are, again, because these are not particularly sensitive collected facts, it had broad access. And I think they've sort of peeled away layers of that in terms of, yes, it's useful for more people to read it, but right now, fuck that. Like, turn the system down a little. So I think that has been an immediate consequence. In terms of with our allies, again, there's nothing in there that is, I think there was like one story from a UK thing where, you know, basically the Russians almost shot down one of their spy planes that was trying to observe Crimea. But again, this is not, it's stuff that has been not maybe broadly reported on, but known in the broader space of, especially all of the really great guys who watch open source intelligence on aviation and ships and stuff over the Black Sea. There's a lot of information that is widely
available.
And so I think, to me, the biggest challenge with, I don't think it's going to change how, certainly Five Eyes, like the core of our intelligence alliance, I don't think it's going to change how this stuff is being shared. It continues to build wariness from the Ukrainian side to us, but that's not new or different or ill-informed or because they don't trust us. It's that they just understand, like, operationally, there is no way to keep information from leaking. Right. You have to keep stuff really locked down.
I mean, so the documents had information about Russia and Ukraine, South Korea and Israel, right?
There was some Israel stuff too.
Some Israel stuff too. and, you know, their confirmation that the US also spies on our enemies and our allies. We've talked about that. So the question is whether, you know, especially an ally like Israel now starts to get very, you know, even more sensitive than it already is about sharing information with us.
Are they still an ally? So many questions to ask, but especially if they're going to sell shit to the Russians,
and especially
which
they're
doing. So
in a conflict. Yeah, there's that. You want to explain what you mean by that?
No, I mean, Israel, and in a way that's totally understandable, and I as not an Israel expert, but just from having observed how they have burned many of the countries I have worked in many times, it's very Israel first foreign policy and military and defense cooperation, which is understandable given history, existence, how they must survive. Sure, fine. They are a major arms producer and supplier of both actual physical arms and more things on the more technological side.
Like Pegasus.
For example, all these things, some of those things are like a half a step removed from like officialdom, but like, and there's a whole lot of problematic things. Israel sells stuff to just about everyone, anyone who is going to pay. They'll ship you the stuff. Except a bit on Ukraine, where they've been not so forward-leaning on wanting to provide things to Ukraine, despite a lot of Ukrainian outreach to this respect. But have seemed more willing to consider giving things to Russia because of the deeper relationships that have been built there over the past 20 years.
Do we know why exactly the reticence to provide assistance to Ukraine?
I think it has more to do with some of the relationships built with Russia, especially the financial relationships. Mm-hmm. And like in a vastly simplistic way, purposeful Russian influence operations since the fall of the Soviet Union to there are many obviously Russian Jews, other Jews, but like sort of oligarchic Jews from the Russian sphere who have created partnerships, outreach, influence in Israel, and used that to cultivate a softness toward Russia, which especially in sort of the Obama administration when there was great frustration with American policy during the Trump administration where everything just became everybody do whatever you want everywhere because it's all crazy now. There was a lot of direct outreach between Israel and Moscow, particularly on solving problems in the Middle East. It used to be people would come to Washington to talk and solve problems and get permission, and not so much anymore.
Not so much anymore. Yeah,
and that's a really not good
especially shift. When you see China brokering, you know, something between the Saudis and
whatever
Syria,
it is like, that they're doing. Like, yes,
the recent summits, the recent sort of spate of announcements that have nothing to do with us or that we were not included in, just demonstrates this idea that we're in a multipolar world now, not just a unipolar
world. And people want to participate in this, like, in the same way Macron goes to France and comes back saying he doesn't want to be an American vassal. Like, okay, fine, y'all pick your sides. And if you decide that China is going to be the great defender of European sovereignty, good on you. Let me know how that turns out. But no, I mean, I do think there has been more outreach between Israel and Moscow in a way that like more closely parallels sort of Erdogan and Turkish policy. So it's very quote unquote strategic depth. Like we will do outreach with everyone in the best thing for us. And we're not going to like filter that for more traditional partnerships, alliances, whatever. It's been much more cutthroat in that respect. So you can either decide that that's smart and you support Israel on that, or you can decide that that's not great, as some of us have done. And seeing sort of the instability in Israeli politics, you can understand the not great aspects of how some of these things have unrolled.
As we speak.
but for example, I mean, on the cutthroat side, and just understanding how weird stuff can be, in 2008, in the war in Georgia, the Georgians had bought because they were having issues then. I mean, the problem with all American stuff is that it's freaking expensive, and there's usually way cheaper options from many other places than anything we're going to sell you. But people who are our allies or want to be our allies buy our stuff because it creates these relationships and sort of loyalty points and whatever. But the Georgians had bought a small fleet of Israeli drones. And this, I mean, granted, stuff has changed a lot in the past 15 years, but they had these drones. They were a critical tool of their very limited military capacity at the time, coming out of sort of a very failed post-Soviet period. And it came out later that Israel had sort of swapped the codes for these drones to the Russians in advance of the Georgian war starting for some information on targeting, and I think it was targeting in Iran, something to do with the nuclear program. One of the things that they blew up to slow down the Iranian nuclear program, they sort of swapped these things with Russia for that information. So the second the war started, the drones like fell out of the sky.
And for anyone who's not immediately like already read into Georgia v. Russia, we should explain like this is like your big bad evil brother like right on your doorstep who's just
and another unprovoked war that you could have seen coming, but everybody decided wouldn't happen, and then it happened. But it was like, and again, would this have made a long term difference? No, of course not. But like, it was just there were a lot of questions about that when it happened
for Georgia,
and it was years later that the information about how that happened came out. But it just it shows the tactical thinking on the Israeli side of yes, they'll sell things to everybody, but there's none of that sort of ideological partnership that underpins these military sales in the way that we tend to think about it. Not always, but
well, and also in the way that we tend to think about our alliance with Israel in the Middle East.
Well, and the I think we can all admit now extremely outdated and archaic way that we provide baskets of money to Israel and Egypt every year from a long ago agreement about Middle East peace, with which they then have to purchase American weapons. It's like this totally bizarre system of we give you tons of money, but you can only spend it to buy things from us. So it's like we're buying things from ourselves and handing them over for free. But whatever, it helped maintain the peace for a long period of time. Only now you have whatever the shit is with Israel. And like, again, I'm not an expert on this. I have my own strong opinions about the semblance of neutrality in a non-neutral world. But there's also a problem with Egypt now because they've been becoming closer with Russia.
Yeah.
They've been, there was a, there's been recent news about how they were secretly hoping to sell a bunch of stuff to Russia and were caught and they were like, damn it, you know? So I think Sisi sucks and, we really do need to reevaluate, especially given the incredibly low, it's very clear, influence we as a nation have in the region we tend to classify as the Middle East, but is obviously much broader than that.
Yeah.
We used to have incredible influence there, and we no longer do. And we need a long evaluation of, does it matter? Like, are we really done? When we said we were done, are we really done? Are we really done? Do we want this region to be Russia's problem, Turkey's problem? Like, we just got other things to do. If so, really? Like, then can we pull our crap out of it? Because we got a lot of stuff based there. And if not, what are we actually doing to rebalance that equation and use the money that we spend on things there in a wiser way, most likely?
Okay. So going back to these documents, which I think we've exhausted, but I just want to make sure there's not, is there a practical impact that this has on Ukraine's defense right now?
I think the desired, again, I think the desired hope of the documents is to create doubt that Ukraine has a plan to win, that Ukraine has the ability to win, that Ukraine can win with limited arms, blah, 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 that we can supply them things fast enough. Just to create doubt and sort of fray certainty.
More about
and
the
thus the answer should be, just give them everything. Stop with this, like, we don't need it right now. Like, just give them everything and stop drawing this process out because it's just costing more Ukrainian lives. And that is very clear in those documents. And I think it is, I think one of the analyses I saw was chilling. And it is chilling that we have known since before February 2022 that this is how this would look and have failed to do enough to fix it, and that we feel good about it, is, and we're lauding ourselves for not doing enough. And yes, again, still more than I thought we might. But we're really at this point where we need to stop the dithering and just give them the stuff. And I don't know why the Defense Production Act hasn't been activated, but like, there is not enough munitions anywhere for anything, including for us. And now we know if there's any sort of actual physical conflict with anyone, nobody's ready for it. So, like, make the stuff. Sorry, just make the stuff.
Is it, like, is it, this may be this may be wrong, but I thought I read somewhere that our spending in Ukraine is now at a level similar to or possibly even have exceeded the what we spent on the Iraq war.
No. I don't think so. No. I'd have to look up the most recent things, but essentially it's like the best money we've ever spent, especially since it's not our guys.
Yeah.
And it's not our stuff. And like the direct impact to us. I mean, the biggest problem with anything in Iraq or Afghanistan was it was our stuff getting churned up and our guys getting killed. And we've made it very clear that's not how this is going to work, right? So like Ukraine, good luck. Let us know how it turns out. But the
value proposition is different.
And just like the percentage wise, what we are spending on supporting Ukraine versus any other defense spending we have done is like the best investment to destroy X percent of the Russian military arsenal is like the best way we could ever have spent.
Even
money.
If you just think of it as not in terms of helping Ukraine win, but as decimating
weakening an adversary.
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay. And there's a lot of questions around that we can discuss further, but like, there's the Institute for the Study of War has done some really good analysis on how this all plays out, and a few of the other DC think tanks have done good sort of cost based analysis on this. It's hard to do in a non emotional way, but I think just the investment per outcome of Russian forces killed, Russian equipment destroyed, even in a very cynical evaluation that this is the only thing that should matter.
It's
good money spent.
I'm checking these numbers now. That was totally, totally off. $757.8 billion was Iraq, so nearly a trillion, and we're nowhere close to that with Ukraine. I think we're probably in the total military is like $46.6 billion so far. So, and
assistance
is 18.3, so
it's not close.
We're not in the ballpark. But
no, and for all the stuff that involves U.S. things, like the supply lines, the support lines, all of it is just so much more expensive than we're sending stuff to Ukraine. Good luck. So, again, I do think it's in a practical way, looking at it, it's money very well spent. You can argue that it shouldn't be our strategic interest to care about one side or the other of this, which some Republicans and Democrats are trying to argue. But I think the money spent per outcome is still, it looks very good.
It's helpful to think about that way. Which is not the normal way of interpreting spending on Ukraine, right? It's like, well, are they going to win and how long is it going to take and how much money are we going to spend on it? But if we think about it in terms of weakening Russia, it's a completely different analysis.
Yeah. And I mean, there's many different aspects of that that should not comfort us because of the costs on the Ukrainian side, obviously. But in the most cynical way possible, just looking at it that way, it's money that is well spent.
Yeah.
And we could not, with the same amount of money, we could not have achieved likely the same thing on territory that is not our own, right? Like, it's just...
Yeah, it's actually
none
an alignment...
None of this makes me comfortable.
an alignment of interest and values, American interests and values, in a way that doesn't often present itself that way. Yeah.
And this is the whole, like... The takeaway from this and from everything in the last year should be just give Ukrainians the stuff, because as many of us have been writing since the beginning, we will not get this chance again. Like, we will never have a very capable nation of very capable fighters totally mobilized and willing to do this work of defeating Russia on their territory in the way that we have now. Like, there will never be this opportunity again. So either we take it and we admit, yeah, the prospect of what comes next in Russia is fucking scary, but, you know, actually maybe not as bad as this dynamic we've created where it's terrible for Russians inside Russia and it's terrible for everybody near Russia. Like, maybe there's a better way for the terribleness to achieve change as opposed to just be terrible. I think we really need to get our heads around this and embrace there needs to be something different than doing round four of a Russian invasion of a neighbor and having not a good response to it.
Okay, I want to turn to one of the other big stories on the Russia front, which is the Wall Street Journal journalist. So last week, the State Department announced they'd officially designated Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich wrongfully detained by Russia. Now, wrongfully detained is a very specific term. It means that Gershkovich's case will be handled by the State Department's Office of Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs. This designation puts his case alongside Paul Whelan, who's been imprisoned in Russia for more than 4 years on espionage charges, as well as Trevor Reed and Brittany Griner, two recently released American prisoners in Russia who were also, quote-unquote, wrongfully detained. Gershkovich was formally charged with espionage earlier this month. So help us understand the dynamics at play here, and we can talk about the specifics that are salient and then maybe zoom out and explain why there's so much energy being spent on this.
Yeah. You know, I think the most simplistic understanding of the thing is Russia has a lot less leverage than they used to have to get stuff that they want. And usually a pretty good way to get specific things, such as people you want returned, is to grab somebody and trade them. And in old-fashioned ways, it used to have to be something worthy of the trade, right? So, like, we'll trade you a spy for a spy, or maybe it used to be, like, 10 spies for a spy because we valued our people more than they valued their people, like, whatever it was. But this whole thing has become very blurry, especially as kind of influence machinery has become more geared toward this. But, you know, trading Brittany Griner for an incredibly sophisticated arms dealer who was responsible for the death of millions of people and could again be responsible for the deaths of millions of people. You can argue about whether or not that's a great policy-based decision. And obviously, like, I am not saying that the United States of America as a government should not seek to free and return American wrongfully citizens. Detained American citizens.
Brittany Griner was the American basketball player, for everyone who's not caught up on that yet.
An American basketball player who was in Russia, I think, for basketball purposes, and was detained with some sort of cannabis-related
marijuana
product.
Pen or something. Yeah,
yeah, nothing super serious, but illegal in Russia. Yep. And it became this whole year-long process to try to get her released. But also should be noted, the Russians are usually very specific about how they go about these processes of grabbing. Once you're yoinked, you're kind of screwed, and you have to be tried and convicted. And only once you are convicted will they trade you. So it's not like they're going to arrest somebody. You know what I mean? Like, somebody was arrested, but a week later they might get out. Like, once you're in the thing, it stinks. And yes, this point seems to have been made slightly more, especially after the Paul Whelan thing. Like, all you guys who made some friend online and started traveling to Russia because you thought it was a great idea because the ladies like you or whatever.
Paul Whelan was who, just for context, for listeners' context?
I'm going to forget which of the stories is which, but essentially started traveling to Russia, thought it was a fun idea, was just there, as far as I know, for pleasure purposes. Like, he would visit. He kind of enjoyed the scene, but was essentially completely set up. The FSB broke into his room and was like, here's this USB drive we found of, you know, shit that you're stealing. And it was obviously just like some bullshit, but has been detained for years because of this. And they don't seem particularly forward leaning on letting him go.
Nor has
it seemed to be always a top priority for it's a very strange. The story is a very strange story.
Can I ask you, because I actually think this is interesting. The difference between, let's just say, then and now in terms of the way hostage diplomacy might work, or in terms of like Russia grabbing someone and trading them for someone, that the calculation maybe, let's say in the days before the internet, or at least in the days before social media, the calculation might have been not even transparent to the public in the first place, i.e.
yes.
We don't know who's been caught. We don't know who's being traded because all of that happens behind a curtain of national security, right? And therefore, the calculations that are being made about whether a person is worth it or not are much more sort of an analysis of interests, as opposed to now with the proliferation of social media and everything, everybody knows everything every minute. There's an enormous political lever that is deployed as the moment we know an American has been captured, and that is actually
not
shaping
always,
some of these decisions.
But in these in the latest cases, yes. And again, I'm not saying that these things should not have, like, obviously
sure.
Brittany Griner should have been brought home. Obviously Trevor Reed should have been brought
now.
Home. Obviously Evan Gershkovich
right.
should be brought home. Like, obviously we should get Paul Whelan out. We cannot leave American citizens detained for completely spurious purposes
right.
in dictatorships. Like, we can't do that. And again, should people be smarter, celebrities who decide to take the money and go to Russia, about going to places where you can be wrongfully detained and become a national security crisis for your nation? Yes, you should be smarter about that. But I'm not
right.
criticizing
right.
the
totally.
Process to get these people out. Because
totally.
Obviously you have
but
to do it.
But the process has changed.
And the Evan Gershkovich case, it has changed. And there used to be the presumption of always, it is better if no one knows, because then maybe you can actually get the deal done faster. Then once it becomes public, where then it has to go through the official, well, there must be the show trial, and eventually the pilots will get sent home. But, like, in the meantime, it will be the circus, and you must be in the circus and part of the machinery of propaganda. And it's very much the same Soviet shit. Like, you're in the machinery of the propaganda, and they're going to use you as long as it's useful for them. And it's not pleasant, and it's terrible. So I think now there has been a much more forward-leaning approach to support. I mean, you know, huge outcry about these detentions. And I understand that. And I think the Gershkovich case is different, obviously, because he is a journalist. He was a licensed, like, he had the official approvals to be a journalist operating in Russia. He was there on an official journalistic visa, you know. He was approved to be there as a journalist. And made the decision to continue to keep reporting in an obviously fraught environment when many others left and are covering Russia from outside now. And again, you can argue about how he made that decision and whether you think it's wise or not. I think it certainly seems the motivation for doing this was an honest journalistic one, which is, I can be there and do this when there's so little information getting out from Russia that we actually see and know, like, what is happening, what does it mean? And I should. Like, I have a duty as a journalist to do that. And I think we can all understand
absolutely
that motivation
absolutely.
And support it, right? So I think it was a brave decision to do this, to try to do this work when you knew it could be this problem. I think there's always also then that, like, little aspect of naivete is not the right word, but you as a foreign reporter working in Russia believe that you won't get caught in the machine. You kind of have to for your own psychological defense, right?
Yeah.
And you see what happens to Russian journalists who step over the line. They fall out a window or get shot in front of their apartment building or end up in prison or 125 other ways of being killed, as many of them have discovered. And you know that there's that cost, and you just assume that that's not going to come. Because truly, they usually do leave foreigners alone. They'll chase you out. They'll take away your credentials. But, you know, the assumption of having more protection would not previously have been the wrong one. But I think this understanding now that this is, it's like a sign of weakness and desperation from the Russian side, which is there's most foreigners have left. There is less of a pool of people to potentially yoink and trade and leverage. So whoever they can get their hands on, they're going to get their hands on. It does leave people who previously would have been left alone more exposed. Should he have known that? I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Like, I'm sure he understood the potential risks. Again, I'm not saying that he was dumb for being there. He was doing his job.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that he's a journalist is important, and we should note that when we're discussing it.
Yeah. Does the visibility aspect, play into who the Kremlin decides to go after? Is the profile of the person, the visibility of the person, a factor?
I'm very curious how this case is going to play out, because truthfully, and not an insult on Gershkovich, but he was like one of the most junior reporters
right.
of that team from that group, right? Like, he was the newest one. He had good access to things. He'd been in Russia a long time working for other outlets, but for the Wall Street Journal, he was not the most senior of the team. So I think it was sort of an availability, like, he was there. Mm. So he presented himself as a target. But I think this, what I'm worried about is there's been this tremendous outpouring of support, obviously, from all the other Moscow contingent of foreign reporters, people who have been there recently, people who have been there before. Many of the reporters that you know and love covering politics and other things at some point did a stint in Moscow because it was like a rite of passage, essentially.
Right.
So there's been tons of support for him, zillions of social media posts, zillions of statements from organizations and things, all of which has inflated the value of him as an object of trade and possession.
He's more a symbol now. He's more a symbol than a,
which makes it more fraud, which means getting him back will be harder. And it's like this, and again, I'm not going to tell anybody to shut up and not talk about this guy. If he's your friend, obviously you're going to talk about the fact that he's been wrongfully detained. But it's this terrible machinery that the Russians know so well, and they exploit it so well of like, once you're trying to free a person, they can just exploit it more and more.
And get more for their...
And it's freaking terrible. And it's terrible for Gershkovich. We're all still a little
bit traumatized about Khashoggi and, like, you know, bad things happening to American journalists.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's just a terrible machine, and the Russians use it extremely well. And it is extremely... I think we're in a not great place with this detention currently. They haven't given him consular access. No one has been able to... Like, they've heard he's fine, but is that true? Who knows?
Yeah.
It's not a great, I think that's not a great situation to be in. And it's not great for him because he must know that he's going to stay there until they get the thing that they want. And what is the thing that they want?
They might not even know yet.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they
shoot for the stars.
Right, exactly. Well, let me ask
who
you
do we need
one
back?
More procedural. Let me ask you one more procedural question about this, because when Greiner was detained in February, 2022, a little over a year now, it took more than 10 weeks. Before she was declared quote unquote wrongfully detained, before she got that label. What does the speed tell you about the changes in how the US is treating Russia?
I mean, I think this was a different case, and I think the speed is, it was different because he's a journalist. Okay. And I'm not saying this was good, bad, whatever. I just think it's an American journalist who was operating there as a journalist. We certainly know that we do not use journalists as cover for espionage.
Right.
So they will have great comfort in saying the detention for espionage is, which is what they did essentially. And I think doing that quickly is important because it creates this different process of how we engage and who is in charge and resources we can expend. And usually that process is slower for an average citizen, right?
Yeah.
Where they will go through the appeal, like, you know, did anybody really think Brittany Griner should have been arrested? No, but you kind of have to go through the process of evaluating the thing first before you do the thing. And I think that has gotten quicker, especially in Russia, where now it's very clear that this is just like the pretense of law no longer really exists. But it's awful. And I just think, you know, we look at this, we have been looking previously at the detention of foreigners in Russia and the process used to get them back differently than we have looked at the detention of opposition or, you know, Russian journalists or whatever, and their trials and show trials and convictions and sentencing to gulag. We've looked at and evaluated those things differently. And I think everybody needs to stop separating those things. Mm. Yes, it is different for Russians. Yes, they put themselves at far more risk. Yes, everything, like their whole family is vulnerable. Everything is vulnerable. But I think we have to stop assuming there will be different rules for foreigners than we used to think, at least for now, because Putin has limited things to pull on, and this is going to be one of the things. Yeah. And that sucks, yes. Like, I, too, would like to have journalists who have access to Russia and can tell us what is going on. I think we need to protect our people, and it just takes so much. It takes so much to preserve their safety while in detention, ensure that they're healthy, ensure they're not in bad situations. Like, are these guys getting tortured? Hopefully not, but it's not unknown in Russia.
Yeah.
And information that could potentially be extracted from them that is of value to the Russians that has nothing to do with them being a spy or not, obviously not, but like, they just know useful things and have useful contacts, and they will, the Russians will just talk at him and talk at him and talk at him. And, you know, does anybody want to be in this situation? No. Yeah. And I think we just need to really look at this differently than we have been, because the point that we're at with Russia is no longer the normal one where you get to go to Russia and go to the banya and hang out with your bros and bike around. Like, it's just not the thing anymore. And I think initially there was kind of this, I think part of the machinery that is supporting Evan has also made this initially made this about the wrong issue. He is a journalist. He was detained for espionage. This is not
right.
acceptable.
Full stop.
Period. Yeah. It doesn't matter if he was a good, fair, open-hearted, loves Russia journalist. Yeah. And there was like all this context being like, I don't care if none his reporting was fair to the Kremlin yeah. or not. Like, yeah. Yeah. He's a journalist. He's been detained. He is not a spy. We need to get him out, period. End of story. I think we need to stay very focused on that and not make it about something else.
Yeah.
Because what if it was a journalist who was viewed as more critical?
Right, exactly. Like,
so we're not going to protect totally, them. Of course we're going to protect them.
Totally right.
So I think all of this, it's really challenging. And again, every single person, every American, every Estonian, every whatever else detained in Russia who is at risk needs to be yeah. given this attention and gotten back
yeah.
however we can do it.
Yeah.
But it's so awful to be in that process, because once you're in it, there is no quick way out. The organizations that you worked for with, ever partnered with, are aligned with, are under more scrutiny and then have all these challenges and like, blah. It's just not the thing you want to end up in.
Yeah.
And getting you back is never simple. It's yeah. not that everybody won't be trying. The Twitter posts aren't going to help. All those things are still going to be done. I mean, yes, post about your friends. That's fine. But it's this whole process is terrible and psychologically damaging for anybody who ends up inside it. And it is enormously hard to explain how bad that is. Or even what it might feel like or look like, even if you're not the guy being fully tortured or poisoned or whatever else, as many of the Russians have faced when in detention for similar charges. But don't end up in this situation anymore. Like, we now know this should be, for us, this should be a line. Like, nobody is safe. It takes a tremendous amount of resources to secure the freedom and safety of these people. And we just need to be more cautious in how we are advising our citizens about how they can access places like Russia, China, elsewhere. Because we're just in a different phase of yeah. geopolitics right now.
Okay, let's, I want to ask you a question about Finland real quick. And then,
sure.
and then a really juicy one from a listener. So very briefly on Finland earlier yeah. this month, they joined NATO officially.
Woo woo.
We need some sound effects there.
Fourth Baltic state. They don't like it when you call them that, but I'm going to call them that. You can be both Nordic and Baltic at the same time. No, this is a huge deal.
Yes.
Huge deal.
Congratulations, Finland.
And NATO now like quadrupled the number of icebreakers it has
yeah.
because Finland, the Finnish Navy actually has icebreakers yes. and the rest of us don't. But we had like two functional icebreakers in the entire American Coast Guard, I think.
Wow.
But I know it's just, they do things we don't do, like Arctic warfare. But
so let's explain to people.
This is huge.
From like first principles, why this is huge? Why is this a big deal? Yeah. Because like, you know, where is Finland anyway? Right? Like,
so it's an interesting question. You know, Finland. If you're vaguely, is it Carmen? Who's the Carmen Sandiego? Right? I was yeah. like Carmen Miranda. No, that's not right.
Where if you're in if the
it's,
world,
it's
is...
one of those three fingers in the top that's reaching out from Russia above Europe, but you're never really sure which one is in which order. Finland is the one that shares the incredibly long border with Russia
right.
Above the Baltic Sea.
Right.
So if you're going up from Poland, it's, you know, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Baltic Sea, Finland.
Just look it up on a map real quick. Just pull it up on Google Maps
it's
and look
really
at where it is.
Really far to the north. A yeah. lot of the country is not densely populated. There's a lot of islands and fjords and other type things. But it's a very unique. So basically, you know, Finland has a very unique history in Europe with Russia. If for fun, you can look up and read about how Finland absolutely kicked the pants out of Russia in the Winter War. It's a story we all love and adore. But basically, you know, during the Cold War, Finland maintained this idea of, you know, Finlandization of neutrality. So they weren't in NATO. They were a place where there's a reason that Trump did his meeting with Putin there. Like it's this vague historical reference to neutrality. And while that has not been the case for Finland in a long time, Finland is a very serious defense nation. They do serious They have serious defense capabilities. They have very large military reserves that are trained. They have a lot of capabilities that other NATO members maybe don't have so much of, except Norway.
Because they're right on the border with Russia.
They're very aware of this. And so, like, the entire post-Cold War period, they have still been training guys, and they've been lately building a long fence along the border with Russia. Because Russia has done helpful things like weaponize migration and shove migrants across the borders into all these other European nations. Yeah, it's really nice. So, I mean, Finland has, what I would say is this is good for a number of reasons. One, it's a serious contributor to NATO defensive capabilities. They bring a trained army. They have an incredibly sophisticated defense industry in Finland. So they're bringing lots of capabilities to NATO that are great for us. Like, it's a great addition to the stuff we have so far. So that's important. And the things that, like, they have icebreakers.
Like, what? Icebreakers?
Yeah. Like ships that break through the ice.
Yeah, no, but
they have a lot of them. Like, a lot of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we don't.
No, but they make really cool ones, and I think we've been trying to buy. So we literally have two. I'm not joking.
Why do we have only two?
Because we haven't needed them, but... And, like, I think now we're hoping that global warming,
what a Finnish icebreaker looks like.
They're pretty cool. Wow. But the Finns are cool. So, I mean, the bottom line is they have their head screwed on straight on Russia. The reason they haven't joined NATO thus far has been the assumption that when the Russians come, they're better off defending themselves than needing to wait on the alliance, basically.
Yeah.
And that calculation has changed. Very recently, it's been sort of a slowly percolating idea in Finland, but the calculation finally tipped over because of Russian behavior, which is like, actually, the thing that's important is this bigger security guarantee, not just the fact that you can defend yourselves.
Was the hesitation previously because of fear of provoking Russia? Was that a factor or not?
That may have at some point been a factor, but really it was this belief that we've defended ourselves from Russia before, we can do it better ourselves again.
Okay.
And you know, it used to be if you were in Estonia or wherever and, people were asking, like, after Estonia was in NATO and people would ask, yeah, so what's the plan if like Russia invades here? Like, whatever general was in charge of US Army Europe at the time would sort of laugh and be like, well, you better hope the Swedes and the Finns come because it'll take NATO 2 weeks to make a decision about how to move stuff out of Germany, right? Like, and it was sort of a joke, but not really, because the Swedes and the Finns are very capable military forces. And the Finns in particular have this deep culture of preparation and mobilization and training reserves and civil reserves and how these things work within society that is so important. Like, the Estonians are the only ones that come close within NATO of who has a similar mindset. But I mean, like, to the extent that most Finnish exercises, mobilizations of reserves, special operations things, et cetera, are classified because they don't want people to observe how they are, how they have been doing these things. So again, a very serious ally to add. I mean, it was an ally of NATO anyway, a partner of NATO, but bringing them into the alliance is fantastic news, in particular because, and like, Sweden membership still pending, alas, because the Turks and the Hungarians are absurd. But, hopefully this will be done after Erdogan's re-election, which is inevitable in May, I think. So hopefully Sweden will be welcomed very quickly too. But it kind of, even without Sweden, but we're waiting for Sweden, it then redefines, again, if you're looking at the map, how we can defend the Baltics, which has been sort of a dangling piece of NATO for a long time. Our concept of Baltic Sea security, because now we have more NATO members on the top and the bottom of the Baltic Sea, and how we can really shore up our concept of defense for all parts of the alliance in ways we've never really addressed. Like, we kind of left the Balts on the hook a bit. And I think after February 2022, this whole idea that it would be fine if Russia invaded and we eventually kicked them back out kind of dissipated, because we know what that looks like now, and it sucks. And nobody wants to spend billions of dollars rebuilding all the infrastructure that has been destroyed, and, you know, people die. So this idea that every part of the alliance was not actually being equally defended needs to be addressed. And bringing in these new allies, hopefully Sweden soon, but Finland now, changes how we can make calculations of air defense in the region, which has been a big deficit for a long time, of force deployment, of how we can do naval deployments, of how we are looking more holistically at this whole arc on the western side of Russia, and how we're looking at the Arctic and everything else. It's really, really important and significant. And like, it's, I think it would also note, you know, the very young, not unpretty prime minister of Finland, this young lady.
Not unpretty.
She's very pretty. Yep. And has been sort of famous for being young and like clubbing and being a normal person in addition to being the prime minister of Finland. You know, her party just not lost the election, but did not win the election. These parliamentary systems, who wins and who loses is hard to quantify.
They were not
the number one. Her party was not the number one party in the country. And for outsiders, initially there was this sort of panic of like, oh shit, is this going to disrupt the NATO thing or the tremendous Finnish support for Ukraine? Is this going to disrupt either of these things? And what was so funny to me is for Finland, it didn't matter if you were the far right party, the more nationalist party, the middle sort of centrist liberally parties, the far left parties. The one thing they all agreed on was actually we're ready for NATO now, and we're going to continue supporting Ukraine because fuck the Russians. And this was so remarkable to see that even though Finland is debating issues of, you know, austerity and balanced budgets and like how do we get our spending under control, the things that are not on the table are these very important questions of defense and how we are supporting Ukraine to win the war against the Russians. And it just, it's so refreshing, frankly, compared to the rest of how the rest of us are arguing about these things. So I think it's, I think it'll be a really good boost. This, the perspective of the countries that have shared a border with Russia for lo these many years is just different because they have to understand the threat in a different way. Yeah. So I think this is going to be a big boost.
And the people seem to understand the relationship with Russia far more than, for example, the American people understand our
very realistic about what this looks like. And again, the whole winter war thing is like a source of tremendous pride for most Finns. But they are a serious, like I said, a serious security minded nation. And this sort of fabric of mobilization, civil defense is sort of built into their system in a way that most of us haven't paid attention to very recently. Yeah. In a way that's super helpful and smart. And so I think that has informed their NATO membership, how they are supporting Ukraine. But I think this is going to be great for NATO. I think it's a big, serious military with real capabilities joining us. Huzzah.
And
I will huzzah further.
Happy about it.
Putin not happy about it at all. And I'm going to be even more happy when the Swedes join too as number 32. And hopefully Ukraine is number 33 as soon as we get our act together on that. So, it's good. It's good. It's good for the alliance.
Right now?
No, I mean, would American support for figuring out how to do this more quickly
help?
Really, really help?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. The French and the Germans traditionally hold the.
I'm
not sure about that crown, and I think they still have it. So, it matters that we're not being more vocal about what this solution looks like or what some sort of expanded partnership would look like or whatever the thing is. I think the good news is that in a way that we have not been serious about in a very long time, we have advanced interoperability support. So this terrible military term of joint interoperability, meaning you, the American Force X, can integrate with Finnish Force X or French Force X and have the same rules of engagement, the same systems of communication. Like you can actually operate together as foreign forces with relative ease because you have the same systems, same rules, same understanding, same cultures, blah, blah, blah. So this terrible term of joint interoperability, which is often a thing that is used as an excuse for why we do not integrate people into NATO more quickly, in addition to things like corruption, Ukrainians have elevated their interoperability with NATO tremendously in the past year because they're being trained by the Brits and by us and by whoever else.
Because they're using all of our
weapon systems.
Yeah, right.
But on a cultural level as well, the fact that they're doing more training with NATO partner forces on intelligence collection and, you know, how we communicate on those issues, on, you know, targeting support, things like that. There's been a lot more interoperability happening, which is important in terms of
getting
closer to how the practicalities of this could eventually be accomplished. So there's good things happening, but the political will thing of how does it happen? What do the lines look like? I mean, there's questions, obviously, but I think we need to be more forward-leaning about how we're looking at this, because what we should want after whatever the war ends is Ukraine and NATO as fast as possible, because I want that military in our alliance and not in our alliance. And I think there's so much pressure already for the idea that it would be better if Ukraine stays out and is sort of a separate thing and is building its own structures. And while I get that in some aspects, as a diehard believer in NATO is an absolutely essential tool of American defense and protection and builds security for the world and for the region and is part of our prosperity and blah, blah, blah. I want Ukraine in that and not next to it being friendly. I want it in the thing all the way. These guys are amazing. Their soldiers are amazing. Their technicians are amazing.
Yeah. Also just from a cynical and interested standpoint, like we're very invested now. And so, right.
It would be stupid to do all this and not finish it.
Yeah, right,
so right. Yeah, that needs to get done. And the political will to be clear about how this happens does not yet exist. And it needs, well, not from us anyway, it needs to. We need to get this done. It needs to not be a question, or the Russians will just keep poking at it until, you know.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. And make sure you're subscribed so you get notified when the second part of this conversation drops next week. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.